You're listening to Stealing from Wizards, Volume 2, Burglary, by R.A. Consul. Chapter 14, Smoke and Mirrors.
Were you really arrested by Knight Commander Talon Dubois?
That was the first through fifth question from Kuro's classmates. He'd arrived early to class because he was already in the spring quarter and didn't have enough time to get back to Autumn and back before school started. Evidently, word had traveled very quickly and everyone knew some version of the events of that morning. He had to re-explain the truth of it over and over until his friends arrived to rescue him. It didn't stop the questions, but Charlie enthusiastically took it upon herself to speak on Kuro's behalf while he scarfed down some cinnamon radish bagels that Marie had been thoughtful enough to bring him. They tasted weird at the best of times, but they were particularly odd with the foul taste of the pillow stuffing still lingering in his mouth. Charlie's version was better anyway. In it, Kuro had been summoned as a consultant due to his expertise in theft and had been promised a medal if he caught the burglar. The eventual arrival of Evelyn stopped the demands on him, as all attention turned to her accounting of the burglary. She, unlike Kuro, was not covered in feathers and had eaten a proper breakfast before coming to school. In the time that had taken, she had decided Kuro was not the culprit. In fact, she explained that she had never believed him to be, as it would take a much more clever and powerful wizard to break into the Chateau du Printemps undetected. Kuro considered proving her wrong. All he needed was 10 minutes and a butter knife, or 10 seconds and a rock. Her room was much better defended against magic than mechanics. The temptation was fleeting, but it was satisfying enough to know that he could do it if he wanted. The bell rang for class to begin, and Ms. McCutcheon entered at exactly that moment. That was her way. Class began at the bell and ended at the bell, not before or after. It was an uncanny ability. Most days, the first chime of the closing bell would act as the final period on the last sentence of her lesson. Today, however, would be different. She had made a promise at the beginning of term that they would be learning to summon their familiars after Samhain, and it was officially after Samhain. She informed them that all other classes had been moved, and they would be spending the whole day on their familiars.
"And it is an incredible misuse of your time," Ms. McCutcheon reminded them as she began the lesson. "The only reason we schedule this day for this purpose is that we know none of you will pay any attention to another lesson until you've learned the spell, so as to not interrupt any of the other classes and to allow us to move on to more relevant matters, we shall spend today, and only today, attempting to summon familiars."
She distributed small booklets to each student as she spoke. Those who received one immediately stopped listening and started devouring the contents.
"I will also remind you that few will successfully summon a familiar today. Conjuring a familiar is a very personal process which requires patience and self-reflection. You will be graded on your technique only, not your success."
Kuro received his book, a small manual entitled "The Familiar and You, In You, Is You." It was a couple dozen pages, and a quick flip through the book convinced Kuro that he was going to have a rough time of it. Just the incantation was 5 pages long and entirely in Gaelic. It was not something he was in the right frame of mind to process. Most of the morning was filled with learning the tune, humming along at first, then singing it together. They were meant to be finding a connection to the words and the music, internalizing it, and letting it speak to the part of their spirit that would manifest in a familiar. They were supposed to meditate on feelings of home, family, and those things that made them feel safe and comfortable. As home and family had rather the opposite effect, Kuro tried his best not to think about that at all. Instead, he found his thoughts returning over and over to the crime scene he'd seen. It was wrong. And the more he thought about it, the more wrong it became. Nothing fit together. The most obvious explanation, that it was a threat. Someone was trashing the rooms to make the victims afraid or to put pressure on them. He'd seen that before. It was a way of sending a message to someone who had moved into an area in Detritus Lane where they weren't welcome, or to someone who believed they'd escaped a debt. Kuro watched Evelyn as he considered that possibility. She seemed unmoved by the experience.
She was showing off her singing skills and outperforming everyone else in class, with the same arrogance as always. Back in her room, she hadn't seemed at all scared either. She was mostly annoyed. If anyone thought the victims were in danger, there would be a dozen peacekeepers on the island guarding those students. Also, they were all kids of nobility. Nobody with any sense openly threatens nobles like that. If it wasn't a threat, then the mess didn't make any sense either. Especially the bedding. He was still picking feathers out of his clothes, and would probably be finding bits of it on him for weeks. They were a dead giveaway that he'd been at the scene. If anyone ever searched him, they'd find pillow stuffing somewhere on his person. He was forced to stop puzzling over it at lunch as Charlie brought an index of familiars and their meanings out again. She was forcing Marie, Kuro, and Arthur to go through the quiz. Marie had already done it, but was hoping for a more interesting result. Arthur and Kuro had both resisted until that point, not wanting to get their hopes up about something they probably couldn't do, but Charlie was insistent. The whole thing came crashing to a halt on the fifth question, though.
"What's your birthday?"
she asked, ready to scribble down the responses.
"It is still the 28th of December," said Marie, annoyed that she couldn't adjust the answer.
"June 15th, replied Arthur.
"Don't have one," said Kuro between bites of his sandwich.
There was an extended silence as the other three just stared at Kuro until it became unbearable.
"What do you mean you don't have one?"
Charlie was mortified at the very thought of it.
"I wasn't really born," said Kuro. "I was kind of assembled, I think."
"Well then, when were you finished, then?"
Charlie demanded, pen poised to take down the information and continue the quiz.
Sometime before the summer equinox," said Kuro, trying to piece together what little he knew. "We had to run away after the coup d'etat, so it must have been finished by then."
"Well, pick something so we can finish before lunch is done," instructed Charlie.
Same as Arthur's, then. It's a bit before the coup."
"No, that's no good. You can't have the same birthday. It's too hard to get you both presents on the same day, and it's better to be during the school year anyway. We should do it soon so we don't forget. Your birthday is next Friday, November 12th. Agreed?"
She looked to Marie and Arthur, who nodded their assent, and she dutifully marked down the date on the quiz answers as though it were true. Girl was pretty sure that wasn't how birthdays worked, but he had more than enough to worry about, so he let it pass. Charlie's quiz concluded just in time to start heading back to class. She read out the results as they jogged across the island.
"Arthur, you're a mountain lion! Fierce, wide-roaming, and independent!"
"That doesn't sound like me at all," said Arthur.
"Marie, you're a rough-skinned newt, passive, mild, and shy."
Marie snarled at the suggestion.
"Are you sure you got that right? Can I trade with Arthur?"
"And Kuro, you're a pileated woodpecker, persistent and always in search of something."
Kuro stumbled to a halt as he was struck by an epiphany. They're searching for something.
"Yeah,"
agreed Charlie.
"Mostly bugs under bark, but it's supposed to be symbolic, right?"
No, the burglar," Kuro explained.
A bunch of pieces fell into place for him.
"They're searching for something. That's why the robberies look wrong, and why they keep happening. They're not trying to get rich or scare anyone. They want something, and they don't know who has it."
Kuro was so excited to sort out what had been preoccupying him all morning that he had forgotten he had an audience. He looked up to find that Marie was listening with curiosity, and Arthur had whipped out his notebook and was scribbling away. Charlie, however, flung her arms up and shouted at Kuro,
"No, not now. Today we are learning to summon familiars. You can be interesting tomorrow. We're too busy today. Now hurry up, I don't want to miss anything."
The other three were so disoriented by Charlie caring about being on time for class that they complied without complaint. She pushed them all into the classroom just as the bell rang and Ms. McCutcheon started talking. 2 hours of dance practice let Kuro work out more of the details for himself. He liked his explanation. It made a lot of things make more sense. The mess was a cover, so it was harder to figure out where they were really looking. The targets were noble people who might have inherited some powerful artifact or some proof of a claim to land or title, like a signet ring or a crown. If Dubois was involved, it might even have something to do with the missing heir to the summer throne. That would explain why the younger students were being targeted. The heir was born about the same time as Arthur, so they'd either be a young second year or an old first year. He felt very clever for his solution, and that kept him in high spirits through most of the afternoon's other failures.
The dance portion of the practice ended with a collective sigh of relief. There was a divide in the class between people who had gotten the hang of it early and were now bored, and those who were bad at it and had gotten annoyed. Kuro was in the latter half. He could do the steps and all the movements just fine, but the timing stumped him. The required tempo was much too slow. It felt like crawling when he wanted to run.
"I shall now demonstrate the complete summoning," said Ms. McCutcheon.
There was a chorus of chatter, followed by students loudly shushing each other so she could continue.
"I shall also demonstrate an unsummoning. It is the same as we practiced on some of your earlier conjurations, but the experience will be different. A part of the familiar is tied to your spirit. When it is dispelled, you will absorb its experiences. The first time that happens can be somewhat disorienting. Also, if you cannot perform an unsummoning, we will need to pop your familiar manually, which can be unsettling."
Ms. McCutcheon then proceeded to combine the chant and movements they'd been practicing and invoke the spell with impeccable precision. As she did, pale blue tendrils of light spiraled out of thin air in front of her. They coiled into place like an explosion of 1,000 springs run in reverse. As they combined, they formed into the unmistakable shape of a heron, which stretched its broad wings and arched its long, graceful neck. As she neared the conclusion of the ritual, the spiritual form started to solidify, growing a full coat of blue, black, and white feathers. With the final clap of the spell, the familiar's eye turned from glowing misty blue to a natural yellow, and it was done. It stood serenely as the students applauded, and then McCutcheon unsummoned it. With the much shorter phrase and movements, it unwove itself, and the streams of light flew back to the teacher and were absorbed through her ears, eyes, and nose.
"You may now practice on your own," she said.
Chaos followed. Everyone sang and danced in their own time, bumping into each other, rolling over each other's tune, and getting distracted the moment anyone else had the tiniest flicker of success. Ms. McCutcheon moved through the room, offering guidance, encouragement, and direction, but somehow managing to stay unaffected by the ruckus. It struck Kuro how very much like her familiar she was. She walked proudly and with precision, but in a detached sort of way, wading through the torrent but staying above it and being unaffected by it. Kuro could have imagined 100 creatures that would have suited her, but now, having seen her heron, he knew it really couldn't have been anything else. Kuro went through the motions of the casting himself, but mostly watched others. As the afternoon wore on, students were starting to get things to happen. Oliver was making steady progress, with more and more misty green tendrils weaving together with each attempt, and starting to form something fist-sized. Beside him, Sean Cassidy was repeatedly forming a beautiful swirl of luminous pink petals, but never finished, because whatever it was forming was too small for his liking. Charlie kept conjuring a huge cloud of what looked like dandelion fluff, but she always got distracted by other people before it could form into anything. Morgan was consistently creating something long and low, but seemed stumped as to what it was, so couldn't resolve it completely. Arthur was robotically repeating the spell again and again, with different results every time. A rainbow of shapes and colors whirled in front of him, but never resolved into anything. Marie, like Kuro, couldn't get anything to happen. But unlike Kuro, she was trying. Evelyn was, to nobody's surprise, the first to manifest a recognizable form. Glowing golden cords knotted together, starting with large, muscular hindquarters and then building up along the body, until the unmistakable shape of a lioness formed. It stretched, and a full coat of fur bloomed along its length. It posed proudly for the class, and soaked in the applause and admiration. Once Evelyn had deemed the quantity of praise was suitable, she ordered her familiar to her side, which it promptly ignored. It faced away from her, and, with incredible poise, power, and grace, lay down and fell asleep. The class laughed, and she unsummoned it angrily. The lioness burst into a shower of golden glitter, which swirled back to its creator. Evelyn blinked slowly and stumbled as if drunk. She looked at her hands on the floor as if she'd never seen them before, and licked the inside of her mouth as though her tongue were a new and foreign object. Ms. McCutcheon took the pause in action as an opportunity to offer some wisdom.
"As you are all aware, since you read the pamphlet so thoroughly this morning, a familiar is not a pet or a servant, but an extension and reflection of some part of yourself. While most are cooperative extensions of their creators, others reflect some less admirable traits. they will not necessarily behave themselves or obey your commands. Some of you will find your familiars to be uncooperative, lazy, or even destructive. They are willful beings and become more so the longer they are out. They can even become resistant to being unsummoned if left solid for too long. And leaving the Vale while they are out and about can sever your connection to them, in which case popping them can become quite an ordeal.
Evelyn's success worked as some form of encouragement for most of the class. While everyone was pretty resigned to the fact that their familiars wouldn't be as impressive as hers, she had proved that it could be done. Veronica Langston was next to succeed, conjuring a gray squirrel that immediately ran away and hid behind a shelf, followed shortly thereafter by Oliver Kagan, who created a bullfrog that just sat and croaked contentedly. Sean summoned a tiny red, green, and white hummingbird, which promptly was attacked by a falcon created by Leaf, and spent the rest of the class hiding in Gregory Zimmerman's pocket for protection. Arthur managed to get his familiar to form, and it was a huge black dog that looked almost like a bear. He was so happy that he smiled openly in front of the whole class. Kuro knew that Arthur idolized his adoptive father, and having a dog familiar would probably mean a lot to him. He and the dog just looked happily at each other until McCutcheon forced him to unsummon it, to prove that he could. Of course, the moment it was gone, he started casting again to bring it back out. But on his second summoning, it was a small fluffy dog. On his third, it was an orange house cat, then a loon, then a bat, then a carp. The last one forced him to pause his repeated summonings, as a classroom floor was not a proper place for a fish, and absorbing its experiences left Arthur goggle-eyed and gasping for air. It also gave him a chance to realize that he'd gained the attention of the entire class. "I thought familiars never change," complained Magna, who had not yet managed to get hers to form.
"Arthur may be something of a special case," said Ms. McCutcheon.
Arthur emphasized her point by involuntarily changing the color and texture of his skin to try to blend in with the wall behind him. McCutcheon urged everyone back to their own work. It was getting harder to do so, though. The dozen or so fully formed familiars were wandering around the class, hunting each other, hiding from each other, or just generally getting in the way. The addition of a full-sized lioness prowling around the class and demanding the attention of everyone nearby was terribly distracting. With most people having developed some amount of success, the room was a storm of swirling lights and colors. Kuro gave up pretending to try and leafed through the instruction manual. Teachers seemed to like it when the students read textbooks when they didn't have to. It also provided him with time to think. His theory about the crimes had some holes. The biggest was the torn-open bedding. Even if the students were hiding something important, it would be strange to put it inside a pillow or a duvet, since they got laundered regularly. Also, he had no idea who was doing it or what they were looking for. As the final bell of the day approached, they were given a few dire warnings from Ms. McCutcheon. The first was not to teach the first years. She reclaimed all of the manuals and counted them twice to make sure they didn't get into the younger students' hands. She reminded the class how they'd had to wait, and how the older students had refused their demands to learn early. Next was to never let their familiar out of sight. They were responsible for anything and everything their familiars did. As far as the school was concerned, a familiar and its creator were one and the same. And finally, she reminded them that summoning a familiar had no impact on their grades, and they should now all move on and focus on their other studies. The bell released them, and nearly everyone made it to the school steps before completely forgetting the last piece of advice and trying to summon again. Kuro expected to walk back to the lodge on his own, but was surprised to find his friends at his side. "Aren't you going to keep summoning stuff?" he asked. "Why would I?" said Marie. "It did not work in the room. I don't think it will work on the lawn." In a transparent attempt to hide her disappointment, she turned her attention to Arthur. "Good job. You didn't think you'd be able to do it at all, right?" Arthur smiled very slightly and looked at his feet. "Yeah, I was surprised."
"It's so cool that you can make it whatever you want," Charlie practically exploded with delight. "What's it like? How does it feel? Do you think you can make something really big like an elephant or a dragon? What about a person? Could you make a person familiar? You could be like twins who go on capers where you take each other's place at a fancy party while the other one steals the precious jewels."
Marie encouraged Charlie to let Arthur have a chance to talk by gently pushing her into a bush. "I don't think I can control it," he said. "It's just different every time. I keep trying to get the first one back, but I can't. Nothing happens when I try to force it to be something. I have to just let it be what it wants to be."
That's cool anyway, said Charlie, having freed herself from the shrub. I'm excited to get mine.
I thought you'd be more sad about not summoning it today, said Kuro.
Nah, I got farther than I expected.
She thrust her fists on her hips and puffed out her chest.
It's hard to think and sing and dance all at the same time, and it was really distracting in that room with everyone else doing it at the same time. I kept forgetting to hold myself up and nearly falling over. Besides, I know mine's going to be big and probably white. Maybe a polar bear. I'll get it eventually. And now it's like a Yule present where I get to guess what it'll be.
Marie, annoyed by Charlie's unflappable positivity, turned to Kuro for an ally.
It is only you and me with no hope then, right?
She said, throwing an arm over his shoulder.
We tried our best, though, yeah?
I wasn't trying, replied Kuro. He felt the arm slip from around him, and he turned to find Marie scowling at him.
What do you mean you did not try?
It wouldn't work anyway, he said. I haven't conjured anything properly yet, even the easy stuff. I'd probably just blow something up.
Don't you wonder what your familiar would be?
Marie seemed almost angry with him.
No,
he lied. He was surprised to discover that it was a lie. Earlier that morning, it had been true. After a whole day of being forced to think about familiars, however, and watching other people have meaningful moments when they discovered theirs, he found that he wanted to know. It came as a bit of a shock. He also realized that part of him was still puzzling over the burglaries. There were pieces that didn't fit, questions to which he wanted answers, and it frightened him. In the flurry of a busy day, he'd let his guard down and had been possessed by a feeling that he thought he'd banished long ago, a feeling that had brought him nothing but pain and misery in his past, one that brought nothing but trouble. Kuro was curious.
Thank you for listening to Stealing from Wizards. If you liked our show, please consider rating or reviewing on iTunes. If you want to support this podcast or just can't wait for the next chapter, the full book is available on Amazon, Kobo, and Indigo. Our theme music was written by Camille Saint-Saëns, transcribed by Franz Liszt, performed by Rebecca Verdun, and used with permission. This episode was produced by Jim Tigwell.